There you are.
All right.
Bring the House Committee on Judiciary to order Tuesday, February 24th, 1 p.m. Staff, what are we dealing with?
Would you like to start with 3021, Mr. Chair?
That's fine.
All right. Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3021, our first bill of the day, will modify the Department of Justice Crime Victims Compensation Program. It makes a range of both grammatical and substantive changes. The largest of these, it allows the victim to apply for compensation within 1 year of the date of the injury instead of the current time limit of 6 months. It modifies language regarding counseling benefits available to a victim if an offender is going through the post-conviction process. And it clarifies that the amount which can be distributed to a victim in most cases is capped at $20,000.
Okay, and we'll open a public hearing on 3021. We haven't done that.
Yeah.
Shannon Seville.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Shannon Seville. I'm the Legislative Policy Counsel at the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here today to speak briefly on behalf of House Bill 3021. This bill makes just a couple of key changes to our victim's compensation law. Counsel, basically sum them up for you. What it does is provide that victims now can apply for compensation up to a year after the event, where currently it's 6 months. And it also allows that, or rather it clarifies that the cap for receiving compensation for medical expenses is $20,000. That was the original intent in the bill, I think dating back to a couple sessions ago. The language that would have explicitly capped it at $20,000 dropped out in the last 2 years, and so we're back here again to clarify that it's $20,000. Cynthia Stinson, who is the director of our Crime Victim Services Division, actually is here to speak more specifically on how that language, I think, evolved and some of the other effects the timeline extensions will have.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Stinson. I am the Director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice, speaking in support of 3021 today. As Shannon said, really the cornerstone of this bill is the provision that will affect most victims, which is probably the tiniest change in this bill that you see. Will extend the length of time to file for compensation from 6 months, as it currently is, to a year. And as you might imagine, victims of persons crimes, which our compensation program serves, are dealing with a lot of things, including often trial or other legal processes during the first 6 months after a crime. And so as important as the crime victims compensation forms are, sometimes they don't get filed. And we then have to deny those claims simply because they have not been filed timely, and they don't have a reason such as threat from the offender or fear that they didn't file it. It's merely they just didn't get to it, which is really understandable for victims of crime. So we are wanting to extend that to a year. So this will affect this provision, this change in the bill, that's very tiny, 6 months to a year, is really the biggest change for the most victims. The other changes are in regards to our benefits for victims whose offender are going through some kind of post-conviction process. I use that very broadly, post-conviction meaning anything after conviction. Last session, there were provisions added to allow victims going through these processes to access some counseling benefits. And what we've discovered as we have had our post-conviction advocacy program up and running since May of last year is that people are unable to access these benefits because of the nature of these crimes. The victims that we are serving were victimized sometimes 20, 25 years ago. And so they have very different circumstances than the victims that we're serving on the front end with our the rest of our crime victims compensation program 6 months after the crime. The post-conviction benefits are very far out after the crime, and it's often difficult. Victims can't get there. Sometimes the direct victim is deceased, not because of the crime, just because of age. And so this is an attempt to make those benefits more accessible to victims. The third change that you'll see, it clarifies the $20,000 maximum for counseling and medical benefits. And as Shannon said, this has always been the intent of the statute and our policy and has been our practice since the inception of the $20,000 limit in, I believe, 1997. Along the way, our statute has been changed in pieces and parts, and the clarity was lost. And so we have put this provision in just to again say that our limit is $20,000. We recognize, however, that there are some victims for whom their injuries are so severe that their expenses may exceed $20,000. We do currently have a catastrophic injury provision in the statute, and then we have it defined in the rule. We had some of our victims' rights partners express concern about our clarification of the $20,000 cap for those victims whose injuries are extreme. And so we have added to the catastrophic injury statute in the Dash 1 amendments language that not only allows us to extend essentially the duration of the claim, but also the monetary maximum up to the $47,000 aggregate that's in statute. And then we have also committed to work on the definition of catastrophic injury and rule with those victims' rights stakeholders so that we can make it more accessible to more victims. So I will say, you're probably looking at the bill and saying, you just told me about three things, that's all that does. It's a rather large bill. We worked with Legislative Counsel Josh Nasby in drafting this bill, and as he was working on it, he honestly came to us and said, folks, your statute's a mess. Do I have permission to work with you to try to clarify so that it's not so confusing? And so a lot of what you see in the italics removed and then the bolds put back in is really just a reorganization. I understand Mr. Nasby is watching right now, so if you have any questions for him, I'm sure he'd be willing to join us today. But really, the substantive parts of the bill are those three points that I just covered.
Zay Schaffner.
Thank you. You talked about uncollected money. How much is out there? Is it currently not been collected for some one reason or you can't get it to the victim? And do the victims pay taxes on this money?
Chair, Representative Schaffler, members of the committee, can you clarify your question?
Okay, so I get a $20,000 victim compensation, and the person that owes me the money doesn't pay me. How much out there is uncollected? And then overall, on all the money, do the victims pay taxes on this money?
Thank you for the
question. There's two questions there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The question about what is uncollected is complicated, and I actually think we'll cover that more in our the presentation in our the next bill that's up. But roughly my understanding is there's about a third of the restitution that is about 30% of restitution is collected from offenders. Our office, when we pay out on behalf of a victim, can be added or included in the criminal money judgment for the offender so that we are essentially a victim and a payee. So what we do is pay the victim's bills after insurance or the payer of last resort, and then we collect from the offender. So the victim is not waiting and waiting and waiting.
Okay.
We pay on behalf of the victim, and then we wait and we collect from the offender with our revenue agents in our office. Your second question is, no, they don't have to pay taxes on this.
Okay, thank you. Thank
you. Representative Olson, did you have something?
I do, Mr. Chair. Cynthia, and to follow up with what Representative Schaffler says, good question. So your response to him was about a third of the perpetrators never pay up. So we're expanding this. So we're just, all we're doing is compounding the third.
Chairs, Representative Olson, members of the committee, we are actually very successful in collecting from offenders. We are not collecting everything owed. My understanding, just to clarify, is that about a third of what is ordered is being collected from offenders. So there's two-thirds that is not being collected. The restitution and recovery collection system in Oregon is rather cumbersome, as you will hear in our next bill. But our office is very successful. We have two revenue agents in our office, and they collect just for our office in restitution for claims that we pay out on, over $1 million a biennium. So because of the nature of the way the money goes to the court and then is split up by statute, they're actually collecting over $2 million. So we're very successful in collecting from offenders. Are we collecting from all offenders and are we getting everything that's ordered? No, we're not. But we are successful and we are we're confident that we will be able to continue what we've been doing and also handle these expansions. The provisions in the bill are really, as far from a cost standpoint, are minimal. It's really more about access for victims. Remember, we're the payer of last resort. So for every victim that files a claim, it isn't a $20,000 liability. Most people have either insurance or Oregon Health Plan coverage, which are considered prior resources. And so we would pay after that. So I'm not concerned that we're going to have a flood of victims now who apply for either post-conviction benefits or after that 6 months. I believe that we'll be able to handle that influx.
A follow-up. So, Cynthia, of that percentage that you're not able to collect on, have you ever broken it down of that group are just not able to pay?
Chair Olson, members of the committee, we have not broken it down, and the one-third number is really from numbers from the Oregon Judicial Department on all restitution ordered and what's being collected currently. So we have not broken it down. There are people that cannot pay, of course, because they don't have the means, they don't have a job. Our revenue agents, however, are very at the same time understanding but persistent and creative with offenders in trying to meet these obligations to victims, because if the offender does not pay, essentially the victim does. And so we try to work with offenders, work with payment plans, but we do sometimes garnish wages and take other actions so that we can get those payments.
Okay. Thank you.
What are some of the other actions? You suspend licenses?
Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, members of the committee, we don't suspend license at this time. I don't believe that is what they want to do. But we work sometimes with probation officers and the parole board and with victims. And sometimes we go into the civil arena so that we can then garnish wages, as I said before. So we have attempted to seize property, put liens on property, and other belongings such as boats and cars that offenders have, and sometimes that is successful. But we have to weigh very carefully what is worth the return.
Thank you. Do you have something else?
I do. Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Just to answer the question, I think, from Representative Schaffler. In 2009, we got these numbers from the Oregon Judicial Department. In 2009, $49.3 million in restitution was ordered. In that same year, $11.1 million was recovered, so that's 22.7%. In 2010, $50.8 million was ordered, and 6.5 so far was collected. I will tell you that OJD notified us of this, but it also, it just is common sense reasoning. It takes, their numbers go up, their collection percentages go up the longer the debt exists, because they have more time to spend in trying to collect on it. But those are the numbers we have for the last 2 years.
Okay, thank you. Sybil Hebb.
Go
Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here to voice support for this bill. I'll be brief in my comments, and I have written testimony for the record, but just from the perspective of the Law Center, we work with many people in the civil arena who are victims of crime. The availability of crime victims' compensation to help them process the trauma and to get through the process of prosecuting and recovering from, moving on from a crime is immensely important. It's even more important for low-income people for whom a missed day of work or additional medical expenses could mean their inability to make ends meet, the inability to pay rent and take care of their families. So for those reasons, we're supportive of the bill, and we appreciate your time on it.
Okay, any questions? Thank you, Sybil. There's somebody else up, but he was part of the DOJ panel, and he didn't come up, so he was Red Cross. Is there anyone else signed up for the bill? We don't have any other names here. Close a public hearing on House Bill 3021 and open a public hearing on House Bill. You want to go right on down to 3066.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 3066 would require the Department of Justice to establish a restitution collection pilot program and to make sufficient grants available to enable district attorney's offices to hire and employ one restitution clerk who would, as their primary task, investigate evidence of the damages suffered by crime victims and the ability of individual defendants to pay. It also directs the Department of Justice to employ collection agents. It appropriates money from the criminal injuries compensation account to do so and would sunset January 2nd, 2014, if not renewed.
Okay, let's have Shannon come up again. Josh Marquis and Brad Berry, please.
Mr. Co-Chairs, would it actually be okay if I have Cynthia Simpson and Fred Boss from the DOJ?
That's right. That's who you want up there.
Sorry for the confusion.
Yeah, and Sherry Steve Dahl.
Rather than do this in pieces. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name again is Shannon Savell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice to speak on House Bill 3066. Providing restitution to victims should be an integral part of the criminal justice and court systems in Oregon. Article 1, Section 42 requires prompt restitution be paid to victims of crime. This is not just a symbolic gesture. It's not just intended to provide victims with a voice in the proceedings or recognition of their losses. Restitution is actually a very important part of providing them with the assistance, frankly, the financial assistance they need in order to address the effects crime has had and likely will continue to have on their life. This program, House Bill 3066, is a pilot program that we have put together to help take the first steps towards building a first-class restitution system in Oregon. We spent a lot of months, Cynthia can tell you all about that, looking at different jurisdictions, how they handle restitution, be it courts, large-scale programs, or statewide programs. Specifically, we looked at Vermont and Colorado, who are recognized as having exceptional programs and bringing in high levels of restitution for victims of crime.
This bill is a pilot program that basically focuses on two parts of the restitution system. The first piece is that it would provide
grants to five counties or collections of counties in order to fund a restitution clerk who would work directly with victims in order to make sure that the restitution orders that ultimately go into place accurately reflect the loss to the victim. It sounds like a very simple thing, but we're talking about DA's offices that have fewer and fewer district attorneys and have ever-increasing caseloads. I myself was formerly a deputy district attorney and had over 80 cases, and I think that's probably the norm. So for this first piece, it would be providing an agent who can work with victims and help them through the traumatic process, also help them just to get their records in order, usher them essentially through the system and make sure all of that information is accounted to the judge and forms a restitution order. The second piece would be to then put five restitution agents to work in tandem with those clerks and those jurisdictions to work on investigating a defendant's ability to pay, And then from that point, to do anything from sitting down with community corrections and looking at budgets and financial plans on how they're in fact going to be able to make meaningful payments to the victim, and also conducting collections. This program costs approximately $1.8 million.
We can pay for that, and we are proposing to pay for it out of the
Crime Victims Injury Compensation Fund. Sorry, I call it the CIC fund. And it would be a loan.
And what we would propose to do is to fund the program for the next biennium to establish a track record of bringing in even more restitution than is currently brought in. So it would work in
conjunction with OJD. And we call it a loan because ultimately you're going to hear from Steve Dole, and you have written testimony from Meg Garvin, who is the executive director of the National Crime Victims Law Institute. And they are in favor of the bill, but recognize that the $1.8 million has to be a loan because the account it comes out of is also the account that pays victims' compensation. And under statute, we have to keep future balances in that account in order to cover future compensation. We propose to pay back this amount in a simple yet kind of complicated way. The current system, for every dollar that's paid, 50 cents goes to the victim and 50 cents goes to the CFAA and ultimately to the general fund after prioritization. We are proposing that 50 cents, of course, would still go to the victim, but that the first 50 cents after the victim has been compensated would go back to the CIC fund to repay the $1.8 million. This is not going to cost the CFAA fund, and the reason is this. As Cynthia told you in the last hearing, we have revenue agents in Crime Victims Division that currently do collection work. Each agent brings in approximately $1.2 million over the biennium. So what that means is that if we are able to, in fact, get this program and have five collection agents working, we estimate they will bring in approximately $5 million or more dollars per biennium. That's more money to the CFAA, and it's more money to the general fund than is currently being collected, because this program doesn't exist, let me clarify. And it's also, most importantly, more money to crime victims. The last piece I'd like to highlight is that this is a pilot program because we acknowledge that we're in difficult financial straits and can't do it throughout the state, but we'd like to. We think this is a meaningful step into actually guaranteeing and actually fulfilling the rights that the Constitution guarantees to crime victims. This would sunset in 2014, so essentially, if you see fit to pass this bill, and I hope you do, we will come back and we will have to tell you in detail what we collected, how we did it. We'll have to tell you the pros and cons. We'll have to come back and tell you if we see that there are ways we can do it better in the future. And hopefully you'll agree with us and want to continue it. Cynthia Stinson and Fred Boss are, respectively, Cynthia is the head of our Crime Victims Division, and Fred Boss is the head of Civil Enforcement. So to the extent you have specific questions about how collections would occur and things of that nature, they are here to answer those, and as am I. Thank you for your time.
Just before we have a start, he said it sunsets at the end of...
At the beginning of 2014.
So it gives us a biennium.
And then the basic money should be paid back?
Yes.
And
we
believe that futures monies could be used for?
The money would have already been paid back, we anticipate, into
would
our...
Would continue to collect?
Into our fund, yes. And the money we continue to collect then comes back to the CFAA and the general fund.
Would that be available for an increase of pay for district attorneys?
It would be available for whatever the legislature decided, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Has any thought been given to using this program with existing local attorneys in the area, and instead of hiring employees, contracting with them, whether paying a contingency or a hybrid or something like that, as opposed to bringing on employees?
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Representative Wand, let me see, I'm not sure I exactly understood the question.
I think
what I understand your question to be is, could the position of a restitution clerk in the jurisdiction be filled by an attorney that's in that community? And I believe the answer would be yes. There's okay.
No, that's
not what you're asking. Okay.
Follow up, Mr. Fletcher. Actually, what I'm looking at is, does it have to be an employee, or can we hire out a firm? We hire out an existing collection attorney that already has the expertise, may even know, for goodness sake, the judgment debtors from the community, and has experience doing collection work anyway.
Again, Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Representative Wan, as we are proposing it, it would be an agent working in the district attorney's office and then a collection agent as part of the Department of Justice. That's how we have plotted it at this point. I know that there is another crime victims bill coming that discusses the idea of having restitution assigned to third parties, specifically so that private attorneys can go ahead and seek out the collection. My understanding, and it might be a better question for Steve Dole, but my understanding is that ultimately what the crime victims community would like to see is that the first line of defense, or offense in this case, be the state in fulfilling the constitutional mandate to provide prompt restitution, and the state and the DAs going forward and doing it in that piece. But again, that would be probably a question for Mr. Dole.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank DOJ for looking at other states so we don't reinvent the wheel every time we have some problem come up. Thank you.
I think.
Can we follow up, Mr. Chair? Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'd just like to note that we looked at Colorado. Colorado's been nationally recognized, and they bring in approximately $20,000 a year. It's varied from year to year, but it's 17.8 million. I'm sorry. What did I say? No. Well, that wouldn't be as impressive. So they bring, approximately $18 million in a year. They also have 87 restitution agents, these kind of clerk-type roles, actually boots on the street going out and doing this every day. So granted, this is a smaller program, but they've seen phenomenal results.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead. Either one of you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. For the record, I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice. And I just want to add just a couple things to what Shannon already has said. The Colorado system, what we've been told what makes it so successful is the local connection with offenders and also the probation and community corrections in their area and the courts. So what we've tried to replicate with this pilot is not the state collecting from Salem, making cold calls and sending letters to offenders, but actually having a personal relationship with the offender to be able to talk about things like, let's see your budget, let's see what kind of things you have in your budget, what can you afford to pay, instead of just the blanket, I can't pay. And also the assumption that there is an assumption that offenders can't pay, and many times that's because they can't pay for their defense. But paying for an attorney to defend you is very different than being able to pay a nominal portion every month towards your restitution. So it's a different conversation that we want to be able to have locally with these folks, and also work very closely in concert with the DA's office, the court, and parole and probation locally in order to collect the funds. I don't think I have anything else to add.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Fred Voss, and actually I'm here just to answer any collection questions.
Okay, committee members, any further questions? Guess you baffled them good. Have Steve Dole. Steve, did you have anyone want to come up with you?
Wants to join me, they're more than welcome.
We'll do you separate then.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. I've submitted some written testimony, and Ms. Seville covered very well what the what the pilot program will do, so I'll make my comments very brief. Under the Oregon Constitution, victims of crime have a right to prompt and complete restitution. The Secretary of State recently did an audit of these rights and found out that the system in Oregon is sorely lacking. House Bill 3066 proposes to create restitution pilot program that will improve restitution judgment orders and collection efforts throughout the state. As Ms. Seville said, restitution is not merely a symbolic gesture to victims of crime. It is a right. The purpose of restitution is to attempt to make them whole after a loss that they have faced.
Oregon's current system is broken.
Victims are owed over $300 million in restitution throughout the state. The pilot program should be a statewide program. However, due to the current recession, DOJ and crime victims advocates are proposing a pilot program as a way to cover costs.
This is an important first step
in fulfilling our promise to Oregon's crime victims. Crime Victims United requests that you support House Bill 3066, and I thank you very much, and I'll take any questions you might have.
Committee, do you have any questions? Can't let him off that easy. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, we have Josh Marquis and then Bradbury and Sybil Hebb all come up.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Josh Marquis. I'm the District Attorney of Clatsop County, where I'm just beginning my fifth term. I've also worked as a Deputy District Attorney in Lincoln, Lane, and Deschutes counties. Originally, I drove through the Winter Wonderland for another bill, but Shannon convinced me that this was a bill that deserved, and it does. There are a couple things for a couple of you. I know Representative Barker and Representative Olson remember pre-sentence investigations, and probably Representative Krieger as well, when they actually had a section that went to the ability of the person to pay. That's generally not addressed at all now. So one of the questions I know that was raised is, well, how do we know whether people have the ability to pay? We really have absolutely no way of knowing now. So one of the things that this pilot program would do would be to put that in place. Things have changed, as Steve Dole said, very dramatically in 12 years. When I started doing victim assistance work, my county took the position that it was a discretionary function that was once funded by a state grant, and they weren't anxious on contributing. And unfortunately, my county will not probably be one of the ones that will be asking for this money, because my county is in unusually good financial shape. Please don't tell the county commissioners that, but that is the reality. They contribute over, my budget for victim assistance is about $170,000, and the state portion is only about $40,000. But there are many counties in the state, and my county is a mid-sized county by Oregon standards, where the DAs simply do not have, and the counties do not have the ability to fund anything except the state portion. When you only have, two FTEs is roughly $120,000, $130,000. So, and to answer Representative Wan's question, part of the problem about sending these out for collections is enormous numbers of these are for what a lawyer would be considered to be an infinitesimal small amount of money, but to victims is a huge amount. I mean, there's anybody who practices law, and many of you I know do, there's a point at which it is barely worth even filing a small claims. But for many of the poor people are overly victimized by crime. They're grossly disproportionately overrepresented. And for them, $500, $700 can make a difference between being evicted and being able to hold their car and ultimately their job. So the idea of having these five, perhaps regional pilot projects where people on the ground who would be able to interface with the existing community corrections people and know, how you can squeeze that particular lemon. And one of the questions raised was, some people can't pay, some people can pay something. What you try to do is get them in the habit of paying something, even if it's nothing at all. So I I think it's a good idea, and the money where it's coming from is not coming out of the pockets of otherwise. As long as it's paid back and goes, I'm sure you're all aware this is essentially the punitive damages fund. So those people who have problems with trial lawyers will be glad to know that that's the money that's not going to trial lawyers for when they get large punitive awards.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I am Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I also chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. As a group, we endorse this particular bill. I guess I have a couple of things to say. I might be in a little bit of a unique position from everyone here, because really what this bill proposes is something that we are doing. About 2 years ago, we applied for a VOCA grant to hire what we've termed not a restitution clerk, but a restitution specialist, whose position whose job is up front to determine losses for victims, to aid them in getting that information together and having it prepared for us at the time that we go to sentencing, us meaning the deputy DAs who do most of the work in my office, the lawyers who have to go to court and have that number. It is quite interesting how often victims don't respond to requests for information about restitution, and in fact need help in getting that information together. And I have victim services staff who have done that, but until the time we actually got a restitution specialist whose job up front was to aid us, we had difficulty getting those numbers. And we go through sentencing, past sentencing, and past the time allowed by law to get figures to the court, which really is kind of the ultimate unfairness to a victim who for one reason or another just is unable to get that information together in a way that the court can understand it and order the full restitution amount, which, as you know, is required by law. In addition to that, though, I have utilized in my office the position of the restitution specialist to work with the courts and with community corrections on a broader project that really focuses on restitution. Most DA offices do not involve themselves. I'm not going to speak for most. I will speak for mine. My office did not involve itself in restitution until such time as it came before the court on a probation violation. I don't think we were unusual on that. But we've gone beyond that now, and with what we term the restitution project, we have a select number of files that have been culled into the project where we have a dedicated probation officer, we have my restitution specialist, we actually bring these folks to court like a drug court. We have a project that really got centered around this restitution specialist, because once we had that position, we had what I've referred to as a bridge across the street to community corrections, where we had this link to post-conviction proceedings and efforts to collect restitution, because now I had somebody who could literally meet with these offenders, work on their bills, work on their budgets. We have the connection with community corrections. And I will tell you, our successes have been phenomenal. Our collection rates over regular people on probation, randomly culled. We pulled these files randomly. If we have 50 files in the restitution project, we randomly pull 50 files out of probation. Our collections are 2.5 times as much, 3 times as much, up to 4 times as much, depending on what time the particular snapshot is taken. And it all starts with our ability to determine the restitution amount up front. It all continues with our ability to work with offenders to get them paid and to work with our partners in the criminal justice system. And from my office, my ability to do that, my grant runs out September 30 of this month for that restitution specialist. And it is an integral part of our ability to aid victims once the case is completed and taking on tasks that we haven't before. So I personally endorse this project. I personally endorse the proposal before you, because I tell we've lived it and we've seen it work to the benefit of victims. One last thing I would like to point out that Mr. Marquis said that really is important. We've selected cases that come into the restitution project, some because they're a large restitution that's owed and some because it's small. The one example we use over and over is a elderly woman from Amity whose car was stolen and destroyed. It was worth about $500, but without that she had no mobility whatsoever. And that $500 restitution to her was worth far more than embezzlement cases with $100,000 in losses that we've also worked on. And the other part, we have the
ability to do with this particular position and how we've worked it into the project is to get creative, because the sooner my deputy DAs know the loss amount, the sooner they can incorporate it into plea negotiations. And we have actively sought, what can you do to pay restitution up front, because we know it now a month before a plea will happen, and to get that money paid up front. Our collection amounts that I quoted to you that are two, three, or four times what the regular probation collections are don't include some, I think in 08 we collected almost $90,000 pre-judgment on behalf of victims that weren't even included in those figures because it was part of overall negotiation. You pay up front, it's to your benefit. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you have for me, and again, I encourage you to endorse this proposal.
Thank you. I guess this would go to either of you two gentlemen. So help me understand, it sounds like you already have restitution collection. So if that's the case, help me understand why this pilot project is important.
Because it's, Brad is right, it's the exception, not the rule. Because of the history, there are 36 DA's offices in the state of Oregon. Many of them, and this was borne out by the audit that Steve Dole referred to, have relied historically on the relatively slim slice that supposedly was coming back through. You've heard a lot about the crime victims assessment and that money. And when you're only relying on, when you're a mid-size office, meaning you're serving, what, 50, 60,000 people as a county, and you're only giving 0.75 FTE, there's no way you're going to be able to do the kind of things with restitution that Brad's talking about. The pilot project would not, presumably what it would do is, what most pilot projects would do is it would show that there you're going to get a lot more return for your dollar than just the $1.4 million. I think the anticipation is it would be a multiplier of that. So it's, it represented to me, it's just not happening in a lot of counties because the money's not there.
Follow up. So I get that part, but you're already showing how effective it is, how it pays for itself, right?
I'm sorry.
And a pilot, you're already showing that your programs are effective in paying for themselves, right? Well, a pilot project, isn't it to show the effectiveness of doing what it is that you're doing?
If I may, Chair Sparker, Krieger, Representative Tomei, first, my program, the COG, is from a VOCA-funded position. That's where the center of the hub is from which we work. That funding goes away. Yes, I think we've shown it's effective. The other part is, and I think the presentation by Shannon and Cynthia, really what we want to do is see, does this work in a broader fashion, geographically diverse throughout the state, one? And secondly, if it does, is this a way that we should go broader? Should it become statewide? So yes, I think you're correct in saying, well, don't we have some pilot examples? Yes, we do. I'll take my office. Mm-hmm. I'm a pilot example because we've done this. But we don't know if it's going to work in Malheur County. Will the same kind of approach work there? And I think, or let's even go to the other end, Multnomah County. If, in fact, can you add resources in a large county that will make a significant difference? And I don't think we know the answer to that question.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. I'll be brief. I echo the comments of those who went before me and appreciate the time and attention you're spending on this bill. We do think it's incredibly important, especially for low-income victims, as has been said. I'll just make three other points. One is that we think that this will help establish better orders for victims. It'll also be helpful to prosecutors because they'll have better access to information so that they can make an order that takes into account both the needs of the victim as well as the offender's ability to pay. Balance. It's also helpful to courts because they're more sure in the knowledge that they have. They have a person they can rely on who can provide them as an expert with information about the particular case. So we think it'll be better in getting orders established. It'll also be helpful in getting orders collected as a person on the ground in that county. The other thing, though, is something that others have referred to as a symbolic aspect of this bill, and I just wanted to take a quick minute and focus on that for a second because I think that the fact that this restitution, which is so necessary for victims from a financial perspective, is also really important to victims because it's a payment that's coming from the person who resulted in, who caused their injury. And that is a measure of accountability and recognition of the injustice that was caused. It's very important, excuse me, to many victims. And so for those reasons, we really appreciate the focus on increased restitution enforcement. And thank you.
questions? Thank you.
That's everybody on the list, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. Nobody else was signed up for the bill, so we'll close the public hearing on 3066. And I'm going to let the other co-chair run the next bill, please. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3142. Mr. Knott.
And thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 3142 will make a correction to the definition of staff member, adding youth correction facility staff explicitly to that definition for the purposes of assault in the third degree and aggravated harassment. That definition actually appears within the assault in the third degree definition, then aggravated harassment makes reference back to it.
Thank you. Hicks.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Actually, I've got to return. I grabbed the wrong piece of paper. Apologies.
I didn't grab yours.
This is in reference to the Felony Assault 3 statute, which currently provides several provisions for attacking and assaulting persons who are charged with... Oh, sorry. I'm Representative Wally Hicks, House District 3.
Thank you.
Among other... designated victims or enumerated victims of the statute are corrections officers, youth corrections officers, and persons similarly charged with supervising detainees at various levels within the criminal justice system. What happened was last year down in Josephine County at our youth detention facility, there was a rather egregious attack captured on film that I'm hoping to show as an exhibit for the community, for the committee, in which a youth who was being detained in a county-run and owned detention facility attacked a paid county employee whose job it was to supervise him. And because of what the court ultimately speculated to be a legislative oversight in the crafting of the applicable statute, ORS 163.165, Assault 3, the case was charged as Assault 3, but ultimately convicted as misdemeanor assault. So, that having been said, I'm going to go ahead and play the film of the attack. The attack itself occurs at approximately the 45-second mark. The figure wearing blue is the victim. And you can see what happens. All right, here we go. And you can see there was a high kick to the back, basically the base of the victim's neck, and the youth makes a break for it by trying to scale the wall. Victim was actually injured quite significantly. She had to take, I think, about a month off of work. Was still charged, I think, with adrenaline at the moment and able to get up and move around, but the reality of it was she was hurt pretty bad. She was physically injured. under the standard of the law. The other two inmates hit the ground, and additional staff come in to take the attacker into custody. So that assault, had it occurred at an Oregon Youth Authority-run facility, would have been felony assault 3. Had the victim there been a volunteer, that would have been felony assault 3. However, since the victim was a county employee, due to a weird quirk in the statute, as enumerated by the judge in his sentencing decision,
that was actually a misdemeanor assault. And as Judge Michael Newman saw,
the state charged this case as felony assault 3, and it went to a stipulated facts trial. Defense countered that this particular class of victim was not included within the definition of that we were working with of assault 3, and the judge wrote a very careful opinion in which he ultimately found that county employees working for youth detention facilities are, strangely enough, not included in the statute. So this is basically a statutory fix. The Juvenile Directors Association, from I don't know if they're here to testify today, but they have indicated that they approve of it. We've done some work on it along the way to change the applicable language, and just hoping to get it fixed.
Thank you, Governor. You're on the list of who's coming to speak on this. Is there anybody that signed up to speak today on this? Come on up.
Chair,
can I have a question? Oh, yes, please.
Thank you. So I'm confused. Where did this take place?
Josephine County, at the youth detention facility.
Oh, at the detention facility,
right? Right, yeah. The language of it all is kind of hard to grasp initially, but when youth who are juvenile persons charged or convicted within the system are taken into custody, typically they're going to go first to a county detention facility. Not all counties have them. Some counties contract out. Josephine County happens to have one. This is different from a, for instance, DHS facility. You know, those youths are indeed within the court structure, but they haven't done anything criminally wrong, and so they're just being kept there in between foster homes or something like that. So that's a different kind of thing. So after the youth is ultimately found to be within jurisdiction of the court, guilty on a criminal offense, the youth will, if the court deems it appropriate, send the youth to an OIA detention facility, and then they'll enter the state program. So we have county-level detention facilities and state-level detention facilities and persons who work there correspondingly.
Follow-up? This would be similar. Maybe I ask also of you, Mr. Chair. This is like JDH, the Donnelly Long Home, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So this youth had been found guilty of a crime or was being adjudicated? I just want to understand where he was in the judicial process.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Tomei, he actually had been, I'll say convicted, it's found within the jurisdiction on a separate crime of burglary in the second degree.
Okay.
And incredibly, he'd been told about an hour prior to this attack that he was going to get released the next day. And so motive, as best I could tell based on his statements afterward, was that he wanted to basically show off. He was kind of put up to it by one of his one of the other youths here in the film, and he wanted to basically get an escape under his belt before he got released. So that was it. If kids think this way, it's incredible the things people do to each other and the reasons. But so that was basically what happened with that. He ultimately was, now you'll see at the very end of this decision from Judge Newman, it says, so we will move to disposition on the assault in the fourth degree, burglary in the second degree, and the other misdemeanors. What the judge is referring to is the youth was ultimately committed to the Oregon Youth Authority for a period up to 5 years on the underlying burglary in the second degree charge that he was already he was there for. That's why he was there, because he already been convicted of burglary in the second degree, but he hadn't been sent to the Oregon Youth Authority. He was going to get released on probation. So the judge basically, with withdrew that release and convicted him, sent him to OIA on the Berg 2 and the Assault 4. The Berg 2 at Oregon Youth Authority is worth up to 5 years. Basically, they're at the discretion of the Oregon Youth Authority people to keep them as long as they want, more or less, until they reform. So 5 years on the underlying Berg 2, but only 1 year on the Assault 4 because it's a misdemeanor. So I don't know if that's clear.
Yeah, so. That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do have my list now. David Cook, Tori Lynn, and Paul Snyder.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Barker.
You may remember the city councilman in Portland who was Cook until he ran, and then he was
Koch, right, probably, to watch. Yeah. Yes.
It worked, so. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Cook. I'm the Juvenile Services Division Director for Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. Part of my responsibilities include oversight of Multnomah County's Juvenile Detention Facility. It's a 191-bed facility, also known as the Donald Lee Long Home. And it serves Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah County. And we also hold youth parole violators who are under the supervision of the Oregon Youth Authority. Due to limited capacity, 80 beds, only the highest risk youth, those who are likely to reoffend in the community, and typically those charged with Measure 11 offenses as juveniles, are held there. Essentially, half of our population on a daily basis are youth charged with Measure 11 offenses, and that just, I say that just to give you an idea of who's in the facility. As Representative Hicks mentioned, juvenile detention staff are not included in the definition of corrections officer in this critical statute dealing with assault on public safety officers. And when youth on staff assaults occur in an OIA facility, or if youth who are housed in adult jails committed a similar assault, they would be charged with felony assault in the third degree and prosecuted. Unfortunately, because juvenile detention staff aren't identified specifically in this statute, our staff don't have similar protections. And we believe, the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association simply believes there was an oversight on the part of the legislature in crafting the language in this statute, and House Bill 3142 simply seeks to remedy that.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger. For the record, my name is Tori Lynn. I'm the director for the Lynn County Juvenile Department. A bit smaller county than Mr. Cook's, in that our total population of youth between the ages of 10 and 17 is a little over 12,000 youth. We have 116,000 people in Lynn County, so again, much smaller population we're dealing with. The youth that come to detention come there based upon statutory requirements in 419C-145. They've committed a felony. There's three misdemeanors that they could be placed in detention for. They've not shown up, willfully shown up for court hearings, or they're fugitives. So the youth that actually come to detention, as Mr. Cook has stated, are kids that are higher risk in our communities. In Lynn County, we placed 288 youth in our detention center in 2010. It's about 2% of that population I spoke of the 12,000 youth. 71 of those youth that we had in detention were under the supervision and custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. That's about 25% of our daily population are kids that are currently in OIA custody. The other thing that we kind of look at as we measure what we're doing at detention are total days of care. So the time that a youth is placed in detention until they leave, you know, each day counts as a day. In Lynn County, we had just under 5,000 total days of care for the youth that were in our facility. Oregon Youth Authority accounted for just over 1,500 of those 5,000 days. So again, 31% of those total days of care were Oregon Youth Authority youth. So the kids that we get that are Oregon Youth Authority youth are there longer than the county held youth that we look at. What we know about adolescent brain development, I think it was clearly represented in Representative Hicks' testimony, is kids are impulsive. They don't have very well-developed critical thinking skills, and they're unpredictable. Many of the youth that we get in detention are also under the influence of drugs and alcohol. And so, you know, combining those factors makes those youth even more unpredictable. Most youth that are going into a youth correctional facility run by Oregon Youth Authority are youth that have been in detention for a while or been in a county jail for a period of time, kind of giving them the opportunity to stabilize their behavior. So for county detention centers, when we get youth that are coming straight off the street, typically from law enforcement or probation officers or juvenile counselors bringing them into detention for probation violations, these youth are at best unpredictable in their behaviors. We're not sure what substances they've been using or what influences they've had that they're under when we bring them in. So again, I support House Bill 3142. We believe also that the staff are supervising the same type of youth. They're at different points in the system, but it's really the same youth that we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Snyder.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties and the Juvenile Department Directors Association brought House Bill 3142 to us, and we support it for the same reasons as they've given. We think House Bill 3104 is pretty good, too.
Thank you. And, you know, there's everybody saying, like, the new science that young people, cognitive things haven't settled and everything. The Army's known that for years. That's why they don't draft 40-year-olds. Any further statements or questions? Thank you, panel. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3142.